History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And they don't have to if we're willing to do something about it. When we ask some questions and take some time to listen, we're always amazed by what we end up hearing. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up educated, we end up entertained, and we also find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. A few months ago, we saw worldwide coverage of the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and surely come December, we're going to hear at least a little bit about the 80th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge. But this month will mark another 80th anniversary of another battle that, for whatever reason, has not achieved the widespread notoriety that those two have. But maybe it should. We're not quite to that anniversary yet, but it's a battle we've heard about from quite a few different World War II veterans over the years. And speaking of anniversaries, this week marks the 17th anniversary of the very first episode of Hometown Heroes in October 2007. It's hard to believe it's been that long, but I want to thank all the radio stations around the country who've brought it to your ears, and thank you for listening for all these years. Have you figured out yet which October 1944 battle I've been referring to? It wasn't in Europe. It wasn't on some island in the Pacific, and no, it wasn't in the China-Burma-India theater either. But more than 200,000 people were directly involved in this battle, and it covered more than 100,000 square miles, not to mention the skies above. Roughly 3,000 Americans would lose their lives in this battle that only lasted 4 days, while the enemy would lose four times that amount. Maybe some of the Navy veterans listening are putting two and two together and realizing it's the largest naval battle of World War II and thought by many to be the largest naval battle in all of human history, the Battle of Leyte Gulf. We're going to focus on that battle today, and maybe by the end of this hour, you'll be motivated to participate in an 80th anniversary commemoration of the battle later this month. I know of at least three of those that may be within driving distance for you, depending on where you're listening from today. And if you know of some others, feel free to let me know. I'll wait a while to mention those so you have time to grab a pen and paper if you're wanting to take notes. One of the most riveting accounts of the Battle of Leyte Gulf we've heard over the years came from a veteran named Jot Horn, a plank owner on the escort carrier USS White Plains.
I was in Airedale up on topside on the flight deck, and I operated the first four landing wires that the planes would pick up with their tail hook, and I would retrieve that wire and get ready for the next landing. I also was the catapult man for hooking up the TBMs and the heavily loaded fighters to shoot them off by catapult. So I had a two-way job, you might say, which I enjoyed very much.
Well, and that sounds to me like a job with a fair amount of responsibility, because when you're talking about taking off and landing on a carrier, for a lot of these pilots, that can become a life and death situation.
That's right. We didn't have a lot to do with their safety after they landed, but we were under a lot of danger because of bad landings or the wires. We had a number of wires break, and they're big one-inch stainless steel wires that, well, they could just chop your head off or mutilate you, and I've had those break, and I've ducked one that put a big furrow in the deck and hit the man nearby on a 40-millimeter gun and cut him all up, but he did survive.
So if that had hit, if you hadn't ducked, and that had hit your head,
that would have been the end of me, yes.
Well, I imagine those kind of situations take your breath away a little bit.
For a while. And then, of course, the bad landings. Some of our, usually a fighter, come in and would get twisted up a little bit. And they would come down, or the landing gear would collapse, and they would dig into the deck, and the props would sling all that stuff around. And I had one come pretty close, almost give me a haircut. And we had several, a number of bad landings, which just happens in all carrier action, you know.
Well, yeah, it's one thing landing a carrier in peacetime when nobody's shooting at you and you have a full tank of gas and a fully functioning airplane, but that wasn't always the case in some of these engagements.
Right.
Now, speaking of engagements, do you remember the first taste of combat and naval battle that you got aboard the White Plains and how that changed things for you? Because I imagine it wasn't the same the day after you got that first taste of war.
No. We picked up our squadron in San Diego, went to sea, and began to do sub-patrol, combat air patrol. And they sent us to, we had already gone to Tarawa and Macon and delivered planes there as a transport port for planes that were being lost in the Pacific.
Right.
We did that twice and come back to San Diego. We picked up VC-1, our squadron, and went to sea ready to do battle. They sent us to Saipan and Tinian, and Guam was in that group of islands too. And we had intense battle there with many, many aircraft coming in trying to get us. And our first plane I saw go down was a twin-engine Betty, and we shot it down, and it went into the sea with a big splash. And you feel funny, even though there are enemies, that five men lost their lives, you know.
Sure.
And then we shot down a number of Zeros and Zeeks, and we were in a group of five carriers and... six carriers and seven destroyers. And we were called Taffy 3. And we were at Saipan Tinian. Tinian, you know, was the island that the B-29 took off to bomb Hiroshima.
The Enola Gay, absolutely.
Right. And we were there almost 100 days to finish that battle. And then we went to Peleliu, and we were there just maybe a month. That was a fairly short battle, and we got through that in pretty good shape without much loss in planes or any ships lost in that battle. And then we got ready for the big one, and that was in... Leyte, at Leyte in the Philippines.
Well, that was the one that is just remarkable and that will, I think, blow a lot of people away when they hear the whole story about that. I do want to ask you, Jot, while we're talking about this and you describe these engagements, you told us before what your duties were as far as the line to catch the tailhooks of the planes coming back in. Now, when fire is exchanged both ways, when you have incoming aircraft from the enemy, you're planes are taking off, the guns are being shot both ways. Were you ever in a situation where you came off that line and were manning anti-aircraft guns?
Only in practice.
Mm-hmm.
I had fired the 20 millimeter only once in practice and 40 millimeter only once in practice, and we were shooting at balloons being towed by our own planes, you know.
So but, you were ready in case it
yes,
ever required.
Yes, I don't know if we'd have ever hit anything, although I did I did shoot the balloon down, believe it or not.
But, well, there you go. Put a little notch in your belt for that one.
Well, just a lucky hit is all. But we were not, we were prepared, but we did not have the occasion to be used on the guns. We were very busy doing what we did with the aircraft.
What's the first sense that you got that the battle was beginning there at the Leyte Gulf?
Okay. We had just gone through a terrible storm, a typhoon that began to rip us up, and we had the welders going on trying to hold us together, keep us from breaking in two, and that lasted 3 days, and some of our ships, because of the 100-mile-an-hour-plus winds, lost some of their ships. Well, we got through that, and we got down near Leyte. We were heading down Seraglio Straits one night when our submarine sent us a message, and it said the whole main arm of the Japanese fleet was headed down Seraglio Straits, but they would not, if they kept their course, they would not intercept us. So we says, well, okay. But at 5 in the morning, they had changed course, and they did intercept us. And, boy, I'm telling you, we were in for it. For this was their main fleet. It had 4 battle wagons, enormous wagons, 8 cruisers, 13 destroyers. And here they come. And, boy, this was a hornet's nest. And we were the first ship to get fired upon. And the gigantic salvos landed on the port and starboard side, lifted the stern up out of the water, knocked us down on our knees. And we thought, sure, we were in for it. We were going to be sunk right there.
So you had survived the typhoon, which yeah. I'm sure those 3 days, you spent a lot of those 3 days probably praying.
You bet.
You certainly didn't have any planes to launch in a typhoon. But this sounds like it was worse than the typhoon.
Well, it was. We thought, well, we just gone through a typhoon, a little hard to handle after that, and then to be hit by this gigantic fleet, which we weren't designed to go against anything like that, because they had over 100 times more firepower than we did, and had almost twice the speed. So we were undergunned and under speed, you might say, and in terrible condition to be up against that kind of a situation. And so we, our Admiral Sprague, he says, carriers, run for it. And destroyers, he sent them back on a suicide mission to try to slow them down and try to get a few torpedo hits if they could do anything to save the carriers. Well, they did that, and those brave destroyer guys were something, because they went right back into the midst of that hornet's nest and began to fire away their 5-inch guns. They were so close, they could hit them with a 5-inch and shoot their torpedoes. And so it was just a battle royal going on. And if this had been the U.S. Navy against this kind of a fleet, we would have sunk them in 5-10 minutes.
That's what should have happened to you.
That's what should have happened, just almost immediately. But something was going on, and we didn't know what it was. But all of a sudden, after that battle had gone on for a while, there was a great rain squall, a big squall of water, like a tremendous rainstorm, come down upon our fleet. And the Japanese didn't have sophisticated radar as we did, and they couldn't see us. So they stopped firing, but they continued to try to follow us. And this rain squall went on for maybe 20 minutes, half hour. And we just were trying to run for our lives. And it was quite a battle going on with our nerves, I'll tell you that, because we didn't know what was going to happen when that rain squall lifted. And here these big ships were still on our tail. And when we got hit with that salvo shells, it knocked out our power, and the gunner gave me a screwdriver and says, "Hey, would you check here and see when we get power?" And I did. When the screwdriver melted in my hand, I knew we had power for the guns, you know.
Good thing your hand didn't melt with it.
Right. My station was right back there where the 40-millimeter guns were. And so these big 14, 16, 18-inch salvos, they were just straddling us, and we would look over and see the orange blotches, and, you know, you could just count the seconds. 5, 6, boom. We knew if they went off, if they went overhead, they just made a terrible screaming noise. We knew we were all right because they had gone beyond, they'd explode beyond us. But when those big orange blotches come up, we thought, well, maybe this one's the one we bought, you know. And they would land short of us. And we just couldn't figure it out why they weren't hitting us. So this went on with them going crazy in the water all over the ocean. We didn't understand why they just didn't close in and kill us immediately. They did come in and with a very heavy fire, they sank the Gambier Bay, one of our carriers, with 14 and 16-inch gunfire. And the three of our destroyers were also sunk, and some of them had 40 hits and almost just took a dive with the loss of about 300 men on some. It was a terrible loss of life with the destroyers. And other carriers were being hit, some of them with shellfire, armor-piercing shells, and they went right through our thin skin without blowing up. So it was there was quite a battle going on here. And the other four destroyers were being torn up pretty bad with the shellfire.
It's time for our first break, but the most jaw-dropping element of this particular sailor's story is still to come. When we come back, I'll also share some of those places where the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Leyte Gulf will be commemorated later this month. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition preparing you for the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the biggest naval battle in all of World War II. 300 American ships and over 1,500 Allied aircraft clashing with Japanese forces near the Philippines in October 1944. 80th anniversary ceremonies will be held October 26th at a few special places you might be able to get to. At the MacArthur Memorial in Norfolk, Virginia, there is a free symposium about the battle, which you may have heard me say was the last time the world has ever seen a true battle between battleships. There will be a similar event in Camden, New Jersey, aboard the battleship USS New Jersey Museum, and in Camarillo, California, at the Commemorative Air Force Southern California Wing Hangar. The 80th anniversary will focus on the role of the F-6F Hellcat. We're going to hear about a couple of Hellcat pilots before we're done today, but first, back to the memories of Jot Horn, who was aboard the escort carrier USS White Plains 80 years ago.
We couldn't understand why they didn't close in and get us all, because there was five other carriers left that were setting ducks. We could only go 17 knots. They could go 33. And so we were just baffled by it all. And all of a sudden, they turned off and began to turn back for Japan.
Now, before they did that, though, and you mentioned that the gunfire, the artillery, was missing you, but I understand the kamikazes didn't all miss you.
Yes, they showed up, Paul, about an hour or two later.
Okay, so you have the chronology, right? I didn't mean to get you out of chronological order there. So they turned around.
They turned around and took off for Japan, and we steamed on ahead. One of our engines was hit. The mounts were broken, and we thought at any time it would fall in the bilges, but it did not break until after the kamikaze. Now, the kamikaze come in, there was eight of them, come in on us. We shot the different carriers, shot three of them down, and the other five selected a carrier. And the one that selected us came down. Oh, he's doing better than 400 miles an hour. You could almost see the guy's face in the cockpit. We thought he was going to hit the ship, but the wheel man spun the wheel, and it caused the ship to slip out from under him. He and his bomb went off in the water, but all of that plane and pilot and everything come up on the flight deck, a good part of it, and we just had a mess there, and I had to help clean that up so we could land some planes later. But just about then, I looked over, and our sister ship, the St. Lowell, one of the kamikazes had come down on it, and it landed smack in the elevator shaft, and I began to see fire coming out the sides. The ammunition was blowing up, and the ship was in just blowing to pieces. And it began to fall back, and within 15 minutes, she began to sink. And, a high loss of life there, too. And that was our sister ship, the St. Lowell.
And so that gave you a pretty clear picture right there. Already, you've had plenty of close calls and seen how close you had come to going down. But that right there, I mean, your sister ship gets hit by a kamikaze and is sunk in 15 minutes, kind of tells you that easily the same thing could happen to you at any point.
Oh, we thought we were the first one to go because we took the first two salvos, you know, and knocked us down on our knees thinking, oh, boy, we're done. But somehow we were spared, and so we began to head back for Pearl Harbor, and they announced that because of our injuries and to the ship and the men, that we were going to Pearl Harbor and then San Diego, and they said that we were going to get our each section would get 30-day leave. Well, I was on the first section, so when we landed in Pearl Harbor, I thought, I'm going to write my mom a letter and tell her I'm coming home. And it took us 30 days to get there because we only had one engine, could only go about 8 or 9 knots. And And I thought, no, I'll surprise her. I'll just show up there.
The USS White Plains would earn a presidential unit citation for her part in that battle off Samar. That was one of five battle stars that the White Plains earned during World War II. And you heard Jot talk about that, how intense that battle was, that how long that battle was. Did you realize how long it really was as it was in progress, or did it just seem to go by quickly?
No, it was long, Paul. It seemed like instead of 2 hours and 40 minutes, like 20 hours and 40 minutes, you know. In fact, we were so beat by that intensity that our legs were shaking, and we were so weak, we from lack of food. We didn't have food or drink for several hours, and or for some time, and we couldn't hardly stand up because we were so weak. We had to lay down to eat a sandwich that the mess men had brought up for us, you know, and our legs were rubbery and shaking, and we had to lay down to eat a sandwich.
Wow.
And so it was the longest naval battle in history, and our losses were pretty high. We had 792 men killed and 768 men wounded, plus 40 of our very courageous pilots and airmen were killed in this combined battle.
And when we talked about it, I don't want to gloss over this. There was a point early in the morning, and this was happening fairly early, but a little before 9:30 in the morning, where the Japanese fleet under Vice Admiral Kurita actually turned around and left. And to you and your fellow sailors at the time, this was inexplicable because they had a clear advantage, and you were just basically waiting to be finished off, for lack of a better term.
Paul, we were absolutely shocked and just wondered. We wondered all that day and later, why did they give up on us when they had us dead, you know? And as I mentioned before, had it been reversed, we wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes. Not 10 minutes.
And meanwhile, he also told us about the intervention of the weather, the rain squall that held them off for a while, held them at bay. And then you mentioned, as you headed back for Pearl Harbor, limping along at 8 knots, which is a snail's pace, you contemplated writing your mother a letter to let her know the good news that you were coming home. And for some reason, you decided against it. You decided you would go surprise her.
That's right, Paul. I thought, well, I'm just going to surprise my mother. So all that next 10 days went by awful slow from Pearl Harbor to San Diego. And as I said, I got the first 30-day leave. I hitched a ride home, and I knocked on the door, and my mother met me, and, oh, I was so happy to see my mother. I tell you, I was overjoyed because I knew she had been praying for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing she said after we hugged and bawled and squalled for a while, "Jot, where were you on October 24th? I says, "Oh, no, no, Mother, it was October 25th. Oh, she says, "No, sir, it was the 24th. Well, you know, we're dealing with a time zone change, you know.
It was a day later in the Philippines than in Maywood, California.
That's right. And we got that out of the way, and she says, "John, the Lord spoke to me and said you were in grave danger and to pray." And she said, "I begin to pace and walk and travail and pray." And she said, "I prayed for about 2 hours and 40 minutes. And then the Lord said, said, your son is safe in my hands," and gave her a psalm. I believe, Paul, if I'm not mistaken, it was the 91st Psalm. And, oh, I tell you, I just rejoiced with her, because I knew the Lord had intervened and had saved not only my life, but the life of about 10,000 other men, you know. Now, I know this, Paul, that other men's young men's mothers and fathers were praying too. I know that. But I know my mother prayed for me, and that's how I got through the war without one scratch.
Was
except
that...
in boot camp, I skinned my arm real bad on a bolt on a bunk.
If that's the worst that happened to you, you're in pretty good shape.
Except I was awful scared several times, and as were the rest of the guys, you know.
Well, and I know that you told me before that you're convinced there could have been six or seven, even more times that you were very close to being killed during your time in the service.
Exactly. In Saipan, there was a torpedo bomber coming in, Paul, and I says, I'm a dead man. And I could look in this Japanese fellow's eyes, and we were firing everything we had at him, and they splashes in front of him and in back of him, and he would hit exactly where I was, right under me. I would have been blown in 1,000 pieces. But the gunfire nailed him just before he released that torpedo, and I was spared because I would have been a dead man.
Well, now, when your mother told you this, that she was praying for you for 2 hours and 40 minutes, were you wondering, maybe she read a news report about this battle? Were you at all skeptical, or did you immediately know, no, this is what was happening, this is why I was spared, and this is why the Japanese turned around, this is why I'm here today?
No, I believe I, having been raised in the church, I believed in miracles. And I, Paul, I believed that this was God's intervention. And we began to read stories that were written on that, and I had read several, and every one of them mentioned that this must have been a providence intervention from the Lord to keep us from being killed because of the overwhelming odds that were against us. And so that was, I believed that the Lord had saved each one of us.
Again, that was Jot Horn from the USS White Plains, who shared that story here on Hometown Heroes 16 years ago. And the reality is that 3,000 Americans did not survive that battle. That includes quite a few naval aviators, and we're going to hear about one of them from one of his best friends. Those two former college football teammates were both in the air above all those ships 80 years ago. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will come right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode trying to draw a little more attention to an 80th anniversary that won't get nearly the media coverage we saw for the D-Day anniversary in June or what we're likely to see for the Battle of the Bulge come December. But the largest naval battle in history was unfolding 80 years ago this month in Leyte Gulf. It's the last time a true battle line was formed, with ships' guns blasting back and forth at each other. But it also saw the loss of nearly 600 aircraft between American and Japanese forces. One of the most impressive World War II books I've come across in all the years of doing this program is called Flying with Iron Angels, by a true Renaissance man named Charles Houston. It includes the program from a memorial service aboard his carrier, the USS Wasp, shortly after the Battle of Leyte Gulf. From just his squadron, there are 17 names of men who made the ultimate sacrifice. And I had to ask him how he handled the emotion of that kind of loss.
I think mainly you just try to bottle it up, because it's happening over and over. You really don't get all emotional about it. You just have to close the door and bottle it up.
Is that something that developed over time, that became easier for you to deal with over time when it happened again and again?
It was always painful. You do get used to it, but it was always painful losing a friend.
And I always try to imagine what it would be like if I were in your shoes. First of all, I can't imagine being in those shoes. But is there a moment when something like that happens where you feel or hear yourself saying, that could have been me, or what if it's me next time? Did you allow yourself to have those thoughts, or did you just tune them completely out?
It was always there. You always knew from day to day and flight to flight it could end any time. So it was exciting, but you lived with it. It was something that was happening every day, and you never knew when the bad time was going to hit you.
And those missions, were they long periods of getting ready, being on alert, and then an intense moment of combat? Were they pretty steady throughout, where you had to be up the whole time? If you think back on a mission from takeoff to landing and the ebb and flow of that, how would you try to help us understand what that feels like from the beginning to the end?
Well, of course, there's the excitement of just the takeoff and joining up in formation. And then from then on, it's just routine formation flying until you get to the target. And then there's the excitement of the diving and gunshots coming up at you from below and any enemy planes that happen to be around. So it changed from time to time, from boredom, monotony, to excitement.
What was the most exciting part of it for you, where you'd feel the adrenaline pumping the most?
Well, of course, nothing is much more exciting than all those big guns shooting up at you. That's quite exciting. But then you do get quick bursts of excitement with an enemy plane coming in, firing at you. So it changed from quick shots of emotion to steady drum beats of fire coming up at you.
So this is one of your aerial victories. In your book, you appropriately titled it, My First Date with a Francis. The after-action report says that Ensign Houston overtook a Japanese Francis, that's a twin-engine plane. It used full power, and by the time you'd reached 20,000 feet, you were within firing range. Ensign Houston's first burst started the Francis smoking. At this point, Ensign Houston began to feel the effects of the high altitude and got his oxygen mask on with some difficulty as he was beginning to get quite groggy. He fired several more bursts at the enemy plane when his illuminated gun sight went out. He tried firing a few rounds without it, but was unable to see his tracers because of the thick clouds. By pushing the circuit breaker, he got the sight on and was forced to repeat this continuously in order to keep the sight on. After firing around 100 rounds in repeated bursts, both of the Francis's engines burst into billows of black smoke and the plane whipped into a tight spin. Ensign Houston had to switch immediately to instruments due to nil visibility and decided against following the enemy plane down, as he did not know how low the base of the overcast went. It's talking about you getting a little groggy in the cockpit. Had that ever happened to you before, where you had a shortage of oxygen and you got lightheaded up there?
Oh, yes. It was a familiar feeling. We knew what it felt like. You just started to lose consciousness.
Did you ever completely black out?
I don't think so. I was frequently right on the verge of it.
Yeah, I've had a lot of pilots, especially dive bomber pilots, talk about graying out sometimes as they're pulling up, or maybe just because of altitude. But that always strikes me as really unsettling. If you're losing consciousness and you're going hundreds of miles an hour in a big hunk of metal, that seems like that could be kind of dangerous.
Well, yes, it's an unsettling experience, but you're going through unsettling experiences over and over again through the whole flight.
And I imagine a lot of the things you experienced were things you were experiencing for the first time, right? That no one could tell you what to expect or prepare you for, that you just had to be ready to adjust on the fly, as they say?
You had to be ready for anything, whatever came up.
Well, here's what came up in that circumstance, according to your book again. You saw a fast-climbing, faint gray shape of a twin-engine plane slowly appearing in the misty cloud in front of you. And I'll go ahead and read it in your voice. I fired. My six streams of tracer bullets were surprisingly bright inside the darkness of the cloud. I fired again, and then I noticed something strange about what I was seeing. My vision was narrowing into two small circles. I looked at the thumb of my right hand holding the control stick. The thumbnail had turned blue. Most of us cut off the tip of our glove over the right thumbnail. Why'd you cut off the tip of your glove over your right thumbnail?
So we could see the condition of our blood. We could see the color changing in our thumbnail.
So these days, if you were to have to go to the hospital for any reason, one of the first things they'd do would be to slip a little thing on your thumb to measure your oxygen content. You guys were ahead of the game a few years, huh? Just cut off the tip?
That's right. We could see the color changing.
That was the World War II version of the pulse oximeter with your thumb. So, naturally, that thumbnail had turned blue. You say, I realized that I was slipping into anoxia, lack of oxygen to the brain, and suddenly I remembered I had forgotten to put on my oxygen mask as we scrambled up to high altitude. By then, we were above 20,000 feet, much too high to fly for very long without an oxygen mask. My oxygen mask was snapped to the left side of my helmet, where I usually left it hanging next to my face while flying at lower altitudes. I grabbed it, pulled it over my face, and took some fast gulps of oxygen. My vision came right back to normal. Then I went back to firing at the plane. Problem solved. But as we know from the after-action report, immediately another problem popped up. The electric gun sight image that reflected up on the glass in front of me, the bullseye, burned out. I reached far forward and down to press the circuit breaker, and the light came back on. The gun sight went out, and I had to press the circuit breaker again. So I'm just picturing you, and I think the after-action report said 100 rounds you had to fire in a similar fashion. I'm guessing you didn't typically move around that much in the cockpit, but here you're leaning down, you're leaning back up. That sounds ridiculous. Did it feel a little ridiculous?
Yeah, it is ridiculous, all right, yeah. But you had a lot of things to do in that cockpit, moving around and moving your hands and your feet.
But every time we think the story's over, and I love your writing style here, it's not quite over yet. So here you say, our landing signal officer had been landing me for the previous 8 or 9 months, and I had rarely received a wave off from him, so I was sure he had enough confidence in me by then to let me come in a little bit high. But surprise, he gave me a wave off, and I had to pour on the gas to go around for another approach, and I had no gas to spare. By this time, with all the gun sight problems, my anoxia problem, and the fatigue from the 5-hour combat air patrol, I was running out of steam and was in a rotten mood, and I was thinking about some wild thoughts about those dirty buggers down on the Wasp. They would just be sorry when I ran out of gas and crashed into the fantail. But in spite of my abnormal mental state, I came around in a deliberately normal landing approach, got a normal cut, landed and taxied forward and parked. I sat there, totally exhausted, finally climbed out and walked slowly across the deck toward the catwalk. Suddenly, the bullhorn up on the island structure blared out, Lieutenant Houston, walking across the flight deck, has just shot down a Jap plane attacking our fleet. The hundreds of crewmen all around the flight deck and all the officers and men looking down from the island broke into loud cheering and clapping. All at once, I was no longer so exhausted. A little public acclaim is so intoxicating.
Oh, yes, right. Everything changed then. Everything was on the upbeat.
Over the loudspeaker, they say your name, say that you just shot down an enemy plane, and who knows, maybe saved the lives of some guys aboard that plane could have hurt. What does that feel like inside when you hear that announcement and all those guys are cheering for you?
You know what a hero you are. Pretty exciting.
It seems like from reading your accounts that you and those other pilots in your squadron became pretty close.
Oh, yes. About as close as you can get. We were up against life and death every day. They were good buddies.
You write a lot about your roommate, Gene Streeter. How long had you known Gene Streeter?
Oh, for years. We went to school at Fresno State together and played football together, joined the Navy together, went through training together and through the squadron. He was a friend from way back. Just a great guy, just full of laughs and smart, capable guy, a very good friend.
What kind of pilot was he?
An excellent pilot. All of our pilots were excellent.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read this whole thing. It's from October 26, 1944, and you label it Gene Streeter's bad dream. Streeter wasn't scheduled to fly until later that day, so I was surprised when I woke up about 0400 and saw him already up and sitting at our desk. I knew he should have been sound asleep like our other roommate, Jiggs Lears. When I asked Gene why he was up so early, he told me about his terrible dream. In it, his plane had been diving out of control, and he couldn't pull out. The dream seemed so real that he had jumped down from the upper bunk, run down the passageway, all while still asleep, and finally woke up in the head, being observed by two sailors standing water guard. Gene told me that after he returned to our room, he was so upset by this dream that he couldn't get back to sleep. He was still sitting there, wide awake, when I got up from my flight. So in your writing here, you're kind of foreshadowing what's happening here, because you and Gruber make it back from this hairy mission, and you get back on the Wasp, and some of your pilots were playing poker in the front of the room, and Gene Streeter was sitting on the arm of a chair watching the card action. You write, I called out to him, hey Gene, it's really rough out there. I expected him to come back with one of his usual funny remarks, but all he did was nod very seriously without smiling. This was so unusually solemn for him. That was the last time I ever saw Gene Streeter. Your book is over 400 pages long. It's a very thick, heavy, thorough book. And I don't know if there's anywhere else in this book that I saw you quote a verse from the Bible. But as you get into Eugene Streeter's last flight, the first thing printed there is John 15:13. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Is that what Gene Streeter did?
Yes, he went in there to help his friends and was killed.
So again, this book is not just your memories, but so many others. And this was written by Bill Finnegan Miller, Torpedo Squadron VT-14. He was an aviation radio man. And he wrote, we were to hit the Japanese fleet in the Sibuan Sea. As we circled over them, we waited for Lieutenant Cole to dive, but something was amiss. He circled again for some unknown reason. Maybe he was already hit by anti-aircraft. So Lieutenant Morrison made our dive on a ship. Ak-Ak was everywhere. We dropped our bombs. As we pulled out, I saw Lieutenant Cole's aircraft plunge into the sea just behind the enemy ship. I saw the ship firing shell after shell at Lieutenant Cole's plane, and I screamed, let's go back and strafe those bastards. They're shooting at them in the water. They were all probably dead from the crash, but aboard that plane was my closest buddy, William T. Billy. We were to meet in Al Depp's hamburger stand on Staten Island when we were relieved. He was from Bayonne across the river from my home on Staten Island. We had planned this meeting for months. Suddenly, beneath us, and heading straight for us, were three Jap fighters. The other planes were out of ammo, except for my turret gunner, E.J. Such, and me. We had no fighter coverage, and it looked like we were hung out to dry. We were mincemeat for those Zeros. I guess we all blessed ourselves. Then, from nowhere, as if by a miracle, this VF-14 F-6F Hellcat came tearing between us and the Zeros. He set himself in between them, pulling them away from us. He battled the lead plane and was ganged up on by the others. He got one Zero, but the others shot him down. I feel he knew he had to save us and sacrificed his own life so that we would get home. Thanks to the bravery of that fighter pilot, at least I would get to Al Depp's on Staten Island for that hamburger. I soon found out that pilot was Lieutenant J.G. Eugene Jarvis Streeter, VF-14, from Fresno, California. In that one second, he was more than enough fighter coverage. His courage will always be remembered by the combat air crewmen who watched in awe as Eugene Jarvis Streeter gave his life for me and the others in those torpedo planes. You see, our lucky streak continues as we return to the Wasp. I wish our luck could have returned Lieutenant Cole and Lieutenant Eugene Jarvis Streeter with us to the USS Wasp. I was getting a little emotional reading that. I mean, I wish I had Gene Streeter here to ask him. If there's anyone qualified to speak for him, it's got to be you. You grew up with him, went to school with him, trained with him, and you performed the same job he did as an F-6F pilot. So what kind of guts or courage or selflessness did it take for him to do what he did?
Well, the ultimate in courage and determination, you can't do any more than that.
Gene Streeter was credited with 4 aerial victories in World War II, and he had actually been given the Silver Star 8 days prior. But his actions that day, his final day, were recognized with the Navy Cross. The only decoration higher than that is the Medal of Honor. And his Navy Cross citation reads, Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter suddenly found himself as the only protection for 8 torpedo bombers which were making a strike against large units of the Japanese fleet. When 3 hostile fighters came in from above, he pressed home an accurate, daring attack, which destroyed 1 of the planes, and courageously employed evasive maneuvers with the remaining fighters, vainly attempting to lose them. Although his plane was so severely damaged that he was forced to effect a water landing, he succeeded in diverting the enemy aircraft from the torpedo bombers until assistance arrived, thereby enabling our planes to carry out their highly important mission. The conduct of Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter throughout this action reflects great credit upon himself and was in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. And the final line of that Navy Cross citation really says it all. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Such a powerful story. And Chuck, your old college football teammate really did live up to that passage you quoted from John 15:13. But at the time, you didn't know that for sure. One report that day suggested he may have been able to get out of his plane and make it to land. You write about how you pilots expected him to come walking back in someday. How you even experienced a recurring dream of exactly that happening, and it felt real. And his mother, Florence, maintained a shrine to him in her home, hoping someday her son would return. Because you were his roommate, you had to gather up his things, and you actually had the chance to visit his mother back here in Fresno.
I think that was harder than anything else. Just shooting down planes in combat is easier in comparison. I had a very high opinion of Streeter. There was always the sadness of knowing that his life was ended, and he never had a chance to go on and do the things that I did later.
What Chuck Houston did later in life is more than we have time to describe. Author, sculptor, architect, among other rungs on his resume. Who knows what Gene Streeter might have done over the last 80 years, but the men on that plane that his sacrifice saved did their best to live in a way that attached a sufficient value to the incomparable price he paid. Those 80th anniversary events I mentioned are listed at hometownheroesradio.com, and if you know of others commemorating the Battle of Lady Gulf, let me know. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.